The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Today on Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy, I'm Mark Davis in this week for Hugh. The United States comes within a hair of a military conflict with Iran.
The president personally was the one who called this off.
A whistleblower reveals how the behemoth of search engines considers our own Dennis Prager a Nazi.
If you guys are suing Google, I think you should use this information in your lawsuit.
Democrats face their racist past.
And you know, you got a bunch of Democrats protesting about statues of other Democrats. If I was a Republican, I might just sit that one out.
And frontrunner Joe Biden is the key individual under attack.
I came up in that community. I came up in the black church.
I'm Mark Davis. Great to be with you. You can catch my talk show live each weekday morning on 660 AM The Answer in DFW or whenever you're online at 660amtheanswer.com. And my home station here in North Texas is also easy to get on your handheld device through the TuneIn Radio app. And let me also invite you to follow me on Twitter at Mark Davis. A week ago, the United States put into motion a plan to retaliate against Iran's hostile actions toward the U.S., including that shoot down of one of our surveillance drones worth over $120 million. Planes and ships were in position to respond, and then President Trump called off the mission. According to the president, it was the numbers of likely Iranian casualties that led him to put a stop to that mission. So instead, the administration launched cyber attacks that disable the Iran Revolutionary Guard Corps computer systems that control its rocket and missile launchers, and the president also tightened the sanctions against Iran. Earlier this week, our own Hugh Hewitt turned to Eliana Johnson after reading her piece at Politico.
Eliana, you wrote that the president's red line appears to be a dead American. I thought he'd fumbled the ball. The cyber counterattack revealed on Saturday certainly eased my concerns. We hadn't done anything, and the new sanctions today are what we need. But what is the state of play today, especially after you said John Bolton's a super hawk and John Bolton is next to Netanyahu on the Golan Heights? It, lots of mixed signals from the White House.
That's exactly right. You know, Bolton is touting one line in Israel where issuing new warnings to Iran, not to mistake essentially what the president has said with weakness, and the president sending a different message in his interview with Chuck Todd and in his tweets over the weekend. So I think you're exactly right. This is mixed signals, largely because this administration has existed, I think, on two tracks for most of the past 2.5 years. You have the president on the one hand and his national security advisors on the other. I think all the reporting that people have read is accurate, that the president's national security team wanted to respond with bombs, with targeted bombing, and the president personally was the one who called this off. And we've seen that several times over the past 2.5 years, whether it's the rhetoric from the national security team versus the rhetoric from the president, or the national security team making recommendations and the president stopping it. But I think this is what you get when you have an unconventional president who often does things that other Republicans wouldn't have. I think that's moving the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem or pulling out of the JCPOA and calling off the last minute bombing is, unconventional. It left a lot of Republicans unhappy. And so sometimes unconventionality is good in the eyes of Republicans. And I think this is a case where it left a lot of people disappointed.
Well, I was disappointed on Friday until I read the Washington Post story on Saturday. And I think part of the fumble was the president appeared to say that we're not going to do anything in response to the shoot down of a drone, even because it didn't kill anyone. But we did do something. We actually crippled the IRGC command and control via cyber attack. And that is an appropriate response. But I sometimes wonder about the messaging. He said this to Chuck Todd.
Do you feel like you were being pushed into military action against Iran by any of your advisors?
I have two groups of people. I have doves and I have hawks.
Yeah, you have some serious hawks.
I have
hawks.
Some hawks. Oh, yeah, John Bolton is absolutely a hawk. It's up to him. He'd take on the whole world at one time, okay? But that doesn't matter.
Last time I was with John Bolton, we were in Israel and Turkey in January. He must have said a half dozen times, I'm the national security advisor. I'm not the national security decider. And that has always been the case, whether it's from the time Kissinger took it over to the president. They're always the national security advisor. The president is always the national security decider. I don't think there is any tension between them. I just don't think the president is going to always take the Bolton advice.
I think that's right. But I also think that that's a somewhat convenient line that Bolton uses, because he certainly has tried to exert an enormous amount of control over the national security decision-making process, which suggests to me that he cares a great deal about having the last word about the information that reaches the president, and being, I think, playing the typical role, really, that a vice president would play in being that last person in the room who speaks to the president before he makes a decision. And he certainly has felt frustration that the president doesn't take his advice. So I think Bolton is being more casual and maybe glib in that remark than what he really feels.
Well, what I don't see in the mainstream media, which hates John Bolton — I don't count you among the mainstream media, Eliana — they've hated John Bolton since he was the assistant attorney general of justice under Reagan. And they just hate him. And they hate him because he's not Richard Armitage and he's not Colin Powell. He is smarter than everyone else. But I see no daylight between Lindsey Graham, Tom Cotton, John Bolton, Mike Pompeo, and any other one you want to name among the national security advisors. I do see Rand Paul and, I guess, Tucker Carlson over there in the small caucus of isolationists, and Mike Lee now. And they are entitled to their point of view. But I think the vast weight of the conservative movement is national security serious. And we are relieved that the president launched a counterattack on Iran via cyber. And we are collectively relieved. And I think that matters going forward. I also think that if Iran shoots down another drone, what do you think will happen?
I think that's a tough question. I don't know, given what the president said, but I think he will come under an enormous amount of pressure from his national security team to respond.
Google has been under fire lately for their alleged pattern of targeting and censoring conservatives. Our very own Dennis Prager has been a regular target as the search engine categorizes PragerU educational videos as pornography, and thus limiting their viewership. But a whistleblower within the organization revealed a document that labels Prager and some other conservatives as Nazis. So Dennis had James O'Keefe on his program right after the story broke. James O'Keefe, you'll recall, founder of Project Veritas.
Are any of the mainstream media reporting this whistleblower?
Well, no, but the story just broke a few hours ago. And Dennis, it comes on the heels of the previous whistleblower a week ago from Pinterest. And many mainstream media did, in fact, cover that story. However, Project Veritas had to get the comment. There's no journalists actually calling these people, getting comment, except for us. They're just aggregating the things that we are already bringing public. So that's an indictment against journalism, of course.
Do you know the whistleblower?
I do. He's actually someone I'm talking to regularly, and someone who knows that he may get found out and hopes he gets away with it. But this is a person who, in fact, works for Google.
We're going to play, Sean, just a moment. His voice, of course, is electronically changed. His identity is being hidden this way. Go ahead.
Apply their algorithmic rebiasing unfairness algorithms to them so that their content is suppressed across the platform.
Specifically, the insider verified that PragerU, the conservative educational YouTube channel, and talk show host Dave Rubin's videos received heightened analysis in the artificial intelligence program Viacom. Viacom polices YouTube distribution, singling Prager and Rubin out as right-wing and news talk.
So they're applying narrative control.
What's scary about this to you?
What's scary is that Google's deciding what's important and what's not important. They are going through and they're effectively deleting conversations from the national narrative. It reminds me of a book called 1984, And that should have been a warning. 1984 should not be a user manual on how to run society.
He actually stated that PragerU and Dave Rubin were singled out?
Yes, yes. If you look at the rest of that video, he talks about how Prager, there's a program called Viacom. He talked about when he was working for the company, they could single you guys out. He specifically mentioned PragerU and Rubin. These videos received heightened analysis in artificial intelligence. And without getting into the weeds here, because I'm not a tech guy, but apparently how it works is that there's a classification that this internal program called Viacom, the user interface, to determine whether it's something to be demonetized via algorithms or human intervention. And you, according to this insider, were specifically targeted. Dennis, I know this insider is credible because he gave me information that I corroborated through undercover work, and Veritas was able to obtain documents on machine learning, fairness, and artificial intelligence, all of which has been corroborated. So he's credible. What he's telling is true, and as far as I'm concerned, if you guys are suing Google, I think you should use this information in your lawsuit.
The people at Google, I assume, are pretty confident that they can get away with this. Is that fair to say?
That is a very important question, and my answer is I think this is a watershed moment right here, right now. I know you've heard that before, but I think the fact that there are hero whistleblowers, this guy may lose his job, and he's okay with that, and they're making hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. They're jumping on a grenade for their country. They can't stop an army of heroic whistleblowers. So therefore, I actually don't think, because I have hope, that Google will get away with this. However, what has to happen is credentialed journalists, other than myself, must call Google corporate and put pressure on them. People in the mainstream press have to do it. I think that will happen because there'll be a groundswell, but we got to get a statement from Google in the same way we got a statement from Pinterest. They would never say this publicly, Dennis, the things that we've caught them on tape here in the full production. They talk about preventing the next Trump situation. They talk about Google needs to stay huge because smaller companies can't prevent Trump in 2020. I mean, they would never say that publicly. So she says, and I'm gonna read, this is a direct quote from the executive, Elizabeth Warren is saying we should break up Google. I love her, but she's misguided because all the smaller companies who don't have the same resources as Google will be charged with preventing the next Trump situation. It's like a small company cannot do that, close quote. Quote, 2020 is certainly on the top of my organization's mind. They've been working on it since 2016 to make sure we're ready for 2020, close quote. Quote, we're also training our algorithms like if 2016 happened again, would the outcome would be different. So they're talking about changing the outcome of an election. They do have an editorial agenda, and for that reason, I'm not sure why the federal government gives them such protections. Because you can spend all the donors can spend all the money buying ads on local TV. It doesn't matter. If Google tinkers with the algorithms, they can determine who becomes president.
Our program is coming to you today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's America's most unique graduate leadership programs offered on Pepperdine's breathtaking campus in Malibu, California. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Coming up, Biden feels the pressure.
I came up in that community. I came up in the black church.
The Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment. Welcome back to Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. I'm Mark Davis, and this week for Hugh, former President Joe Biden was the clear frontrunner as Democrats headed into their first debate a few days back. But Biden has a long history in politics, and that makes him vulnerable to progressives as they sift through decades of his time as a United States Senator from Delaware. Progressives, as you may have noticed, can be very unforgiving, and they found what they believe are fatal flaws in Biden, as he admitted to working well with segregationists in the past. Now, by rule, progressives don't work well with their political enemies. They criticize them, shun them, work to silence them. Writer Kevin Williamson found this out the hard way, personally witnessing attacks like this when he was hired to write for The Atlantic, an experiment brought to a quick halt by the outrage mob. Kevin Williamson wrote an article for National Review called Joe and the Segs, and he talked to Seth Liebson on 960 The Patriot in Phoenix.
I think you hit on something when you wrote that Democrats do not much care for being reminded of their party's history of frank and energetic racism. I think this was the real crime here, is as over the past, what now, maybe 3-4 years where people have been woken up to the fact that, you know, the segregationists, the racists, really mostly came, the KKK came from the Democratic Party. Democrats have been trying to put the quietus on that. And here comes good old Joe Biden, not meaning to, but reminding the world that when he was talking about being civil to people on the other side, he wasn't talking about Republicans, as it turns out, huh?
Yeah, you know, I heard an essay about this a couple of years ago at the beginning of some of these scandals about, or the controversies about, the Confederate statues in various places around the country. And, you know, you got a bunch of Democrats protesting about statues of other Democrats. If I was a Republican, I might just sit that one out.
Right. grab the popcorn and watch it. Right.
Yeah, so Biden, of course, stepped in it for two reasons. One is that by talking about having a cordial relationship with these senators with whom he had deep and important moral disagreements, and still managed to work together on issues of common interest, offended the kind of basic 101 social justice warrior code of conduct, which is that people who don't agree with you must be shunned, must be screamed at,
good
must
point.
Be thought to be evil,
right.
Must be avoided. And the idea of having, you know, some sort of cordial relationship or just simply seeking common interest with people with whom you have deep moral disagreements is alien to them. But I wonder what they think the alternative to that is.
Right.
I mean, these people, they were in the Senate, they were there. And we still have people with whom we have deep moral disagreements. I mean, there are people in the Senate who have radically different views from one another on abortion and war and all sorts of other things. Are they supposed to just not speak and not, you know, go to lunch and not co-sponsor legislation on taxes or regulatory reform or anything else? That seems crazy. But I think you're right that the main thing is the Democrats really don't want to be reminded too much about the history that they have, which is not, you know, all that ancient history. The 1960s and 1970s weren't that long ago. And one of the things that bugs me about this particularly is this sort of rhetorical dodge they do. They say, well, these people were conservatives. So, yeah, they're in the Democratic Party, but they weren't really like us. They were conservatives. And that's not really true.
Right.
You know, Biden mentioned Talmadge and Eastland.
Right.
And these were New Deal progressives who voted for the creation of Medicaid, Medicare, things like that. They were in favor of welfare spending, minimum wage, all the, you know, kind of Roosevelt and through the Great Society progressive programs. You know, the segregationists were instrumental in getting Social Security created, among other things.
Right.
Now, they did try to structure it in such a way as to not confer any advantages on Black Americans, but they were, by any reasonable definition of the word, conservatives. So if you look at, you know, in the 1960s, you got the fight over the creation of Medicare. You've got Ronald Reagan out there calling it socialism.
Right.
You've got segregationist Democrats supporting it.
Right.
How do we look back from this point of view and say, well, those guys were the conservatives? It just doesn't make any sense. Certainly not in the sense that conservative has a political meaning in 2019.
Right. Salem host Larry Elder is among those who do not see Joe Biden as the likely Democrat nominee when all the dust settles. He talked about Biden's effort to appease the progressives.
I've told you many times Joe Biden is dead man walking. He just doesn't realize it. The reason I say that is because Joe Biden is being buoyed right now because of the support he's getting from the Black community. But little by little, that support's going to go away as his rivals chew into it and as people chew into Joe Biden's record. Recently, Joe Biden was saying that he's a guy that can beat Donald Trump and he's a guy who can work across the aisle. And he gave an example of working with two members of his own party, so he wasn't giving an example about reaching across the aisle. He was talking about two segregationist Democrats, Eastland and Talmadge. And he was saying, you know, even though they were people with whom I disagree, we were able to get things done. And that Eastland never called me boy. Apparently Eastland was fond of referring to people, including Black people, as boy. And Joe Biden said he never called me boy, he called me son. And Joe Biden was trying to explain that Al Sharpton, the term son, is even more belittling because it meant that he wasn't even good enough to be boy. Listen to Joe Biden try to explain his way out of this.
But it wasn't said in any of that context at all.
But you understand they would would never call me son. They call me boy.
No, but they call Teddy Kennedy boy. That was the distinction. The reason he called me senator is trying to demean me more because he said, I'm not even qualified to be in the Senate.
This is sad, isn't it? This is just pathetic. Joe, it doesn't matter what you say. You have been willfully distorted. You know you've been willfully distorted. Cory Booker willfully distorted you. Al Sharpton is a race card consummate player, and here he is telling you that you ought to apologize? It is insane.
I'm not old enough. I'm a kid. Mm-hmm. I'm a kid.
To those
makes you look weak, Joe. Stop digging.
That are listening and those that have respected you but that were hurt by that, what do you say to them? I've heard your justification and you're explaining it, but you're saying to them you understand the feeling.
I do understand the feeling. Look, as you know, Rev.
Well, and Rev, for those who believe that you were in the middle of a riot of Crown Heights and that you fomented with your rhetoric about put the yarmulke on, and for those who feel that you refer to the mayor as an N-word whore, and for those who feel that you were in the streets of Ferguson improperly yelling, no justice, no peace, for those who believe that you falsely accused a white man of raping DeWanna Brawley, what do you say about that, Rev?
You know about me in Delaware.
Really? Honestly?
I came up in that community. I came up in the black church. I came up because that's where we got.
I'm blacker than you are, Rev.
We sit down to organize, to go out.
You should see me do the moonwalk. Very innocuous comment. All he was saying is that, you know, I'm the kind of guy who can get along with people. There's some scumbags over here that I work with, and I got along with those guys. We got things done. So there's no reason why I can't work with today's Republicans. That's all he was saying. And Biden, for whatever reason, contacted Cory Booker, not to apologize, but just to clear the air. And it made it worse. Cory Booker then said, well, he doesn't owe me an apology. He owes the country an apology. Cory Booker says he and Biden had a very constructive conversation.
I didn't understand that. I think I listened to the full totality of what he was talking about. And frankly, I heard...
He listened to the full totality, not just the half totality, but the entire totality. He listened to the totality of the totality. That's what he did.
From many, many African Americans who found the comments hurtful. Look, we make mistakes. We sometimes tread upon issues that maybe we aren't knowledgeable of. I don't think the vice president should need this lesson, but this was a time for him to be healing and to be helpful, especially at a time that he is looking to bring this party together and lead us in what is the most important election of our lifetime. And I was disappointed. I've said my piece. We had a very constructive conversation. Again, I have a tremendous amount of respect and appreciation for the vice president.
Healing. He should have been healing.
The Town Hall Review podcast is brought to you in partnership with Alliance Defending Freedom. ADF provides help at no cost to those whose liberty is being violated, but they can't do it without your help. So call 1-800-691-8969. That's 1-800-691-8969, or just click on the banner ad at townhallreview.com. Coming up, the governor of California wants to provide free health insurance to people in the state illegally.
Is this something he really thinks is in the best interest of the state or in the best interest of his own run for the presidency in 6 years hence?
The Town Hall Review continues in a moment. Welcome back to Town Hall Review, brought to you in partnership with ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. I'm Mark Davis. Victor Davis Hanson published a recent article called America's First Third World State, an indictment on the politics of California, where homelessness and unsanitary conditions highlight many of the cities that were once beautiful in the Golden State. And now, California is strongly considering covering the health care costs of illegal immigrants. Pete Peterson, dean of the Pepperdine School of Public Policy and resident of the state of California, was a guest on the Hugh Hewitt Show.
California's budget is being developed right now under the new radical governor, Gavin Newsom, and he's a radical. And it's going to extend public health insurance to young undocumented immigrants if it passes. It will extend it to people. It's the first step towards making it basically a British health system. Anyone under 25, whether or not they are citizens, whether or not they're here with permission or without permission, will have the ability to sign up for Medi-Cal. Now, I always say, people, that's not really health care. That's paper. But it's still going to cost money. What do you think of this, Pete Peterson?
Well, it's going to cost at least $100 million in the first year, and I'm sure, as with so many of these estimates, it's a woeful undercount or underestimate. I think it's an idea, really, that as we teach in the policy school, you have to know how incentives work, and especially with these government policies, especially here in the state of California. I just wish Governor Newsom was not trying to make campaign promises as governor, but I think this is evidence of the fact that he's already running for 2024. And I think that's really one of the battles that the state faces now, especially under Newsom's leadership, are the issues that he's raising, like this one with health care for those in the country illegally. Is this something he really thinks is in the best interest of the state, or in the best interest of his own run for the presidency and 6 years hence?
Well, I do believe that if you're actually going to move to single payer, you want to move to single payer. You don't want to screw around with Medi-Cal because it doesn't work. And what we discovered in Orange County, Pete Peters, and I served 17 years on the Children and Families Commission, which took the Prop 10 money and tried to make children healthy and ready to learn by age 5. But we discovered you can give people insurance, Medi-Cal dental insurance. They don't get appointments with the dentist. Dentists won't. You can't make it up on volume when you're losing money with every patient visit. You just can't do it. And so it's not really health care.
Yeah, and supply and demand, we are not addressing the supply issue of medical providers, right? We're only addressing the demand issue and increasing that. So you're absolutely right. This is an unsustainable decision.
We also learned in that tenure that we could not find enough incentives to get pediatric neurologists and other specialists to move to California because even if we paid off their debt and even if we gave them a bonus, they couldn't afford to live with the same quality of life as they could in other places. We're going to run out of doctors pretty soon.
No, that's right, Hugh. And it's obviously something that might be one of those issues along the coast, as you say, where this kind of California ideal is experienced. People are realizing that particularly along the coast and the coastal cities, these have become almost completely unaffordable places for people in the middle or even upper middle class.
So my last question, Dean Pete Peterson, again, with the Pepperdine School of Public Policy, one of the sponsors of TownHallReview.com. I am curious about the impact of all of this, if it's being driven in part, at least, by the Democratic presidential primary, beginning on the day that the Iowa caucuses actually hold their caucus vote. So whoever wins Iowa and then New Hampshire will get an enormous burst during early voting, which is enormous in the Golden State. So there is a huge leftward tilt in the Democratic Party, and then there's a huge payoff for being the most left-wing candidate come time that California vote 30 days after Iowa. They collect them all, but the voting begins that day. What is going on in California? I mean, they're going full European without the experience and without the transparency. Is it driven by Democratic Party politics?
I think it is. You know, Hugh, you and I have talked about this split in the Democratic Party between what I call the beer and pretzel Democrats, the private sector union, lower middle class, and the wine and cheese Democrats, those that are much more aggressive on issues of the environment and identity politics. And I think what we're seeing now is a real split in the party. We're seeing it, these wine and cheese Democrats on the ascent here in California, and we're seeing the challenges that provides to those in the lower and middle classes. And I think we're going to see it reverberate into the presidential race as well. We're already seeing it really in the split of candidates and the fact that Biden is in the lead, but is obviously, as you mentioned earlier, certainly had a very rough last couple days.
And I do believe Gavin Newsom is running for president. That's actually driving a lot of that. Is there anyone doubt that?
No, I think that's what's so really concerning as a Californian, to be under the leadership of a governor that you're wondering whether they're really doing what's best for the state, or really just trying to lead this state, so-called state of resistance, really in their own best interest towards an eventual presidential candidacy.
For more of that conversation, go to townhallreview.com. Our program is coming to you today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. They're preparing grounded leaders who are impacting public policy and serving in the public square. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Coming up,
the Republicans took that over. They became the devil.
Reparations, when the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment. Welcome back to Town Hall Review. I'm Mark Davis, coming to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. With Democrats in control of the House, we're now witnessing some of the chaos that can come with progressivism. Recently, reparations got a hearing. Folks like actor Danny Glover argued in favor of payouts to descendants of slaves. Salem host Mike Gallagher discussed the implications.
In 2020, a lot of Americans who are undecided are going to have to decide whether to pull the lever for the Republicans or the Democrats. I want you to hear what one of the witnesses to Representative Sheila Jackson Lee's insane hearings on slavery reparations had to say about Republicans. I imagine we have a few Republicans who listen to the Mike Gallagher show. So listen to what activist and writer and author Julianne Malvo calls us during this testimony, which also featured the pearls of wisdom from Danny Glover, an actor and a Trump hater. What Danny Glover has to do with slavery reparations is a little bit lost on me. Well, pretty much as this lady who writes for USA Today is lost on me. But here's what she had to say as part of this circus, this theater, this charade. This is from C-SPAN and Gravian.
People want to talk ugly about Democrats. People change their ideologies. So the Democrats were the devil once upon a time. There was this group called the Red Shirts, which were the Klan. They were Democrats. However, the Republicans took that over. They became the devil. And I'm just saying, forgive me, Brother Chairman. I know you said I'm not supposed to say that. Forgive me.
As if that wasn't enough, let's listen to Danny Glover and presidential candidate, and I put that in big quotes, Eric Swalwell had to say about reparations.
Then certainly the capacity that we have in terms of imagining a better future for African-American children and African-Americans, the descendants of slaves. And we also would imagine a better opportunities for this country as well.
Thank you, Mr. Glover.
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Swalwell.
Mr. Chairman, can I just say to your, I wanted to put this on the record. I was not in the House when your resolution came up for a vote, but I would have voted to support it. I am sorry that it is something our government was responsible for. And Mitch McConnell may be right that no one alive is responsible for what happened then, but everyone alive is responsible to do something now. Thank you.
Thank you.
Clap for that. No one was responsible for what happened then, but everybody is responsible for what we do now, which is get out our checkbooks if we're not black and write checks to black Americans. Okay? Got it. There's no way the Democrats think this advances their side. There's just no way. I'm starting to think Sheila Jackson Lee is a secret plant from the Republican Party. Honest to goodness. And here's what cracks me up even more so. This whole lie that if you're a conservative, you must be a racist, and liberals just don't have a racist bone in their body. Check out the reaction that liberalism had to a really smart, bright 23-year-old columnist named Coleman Hughes. Coleman Hughes writes for Quillette, and he was invited to testify. Don't know why Sheila Jackson Lee let him in. He must have snuck in without her realizing it. And here's cut six as he explained what a bad idea, what a terrible idea it is for Americans to have to grapple with the issue of reparations.
The people who are owed for slavery are no longer here, and we are not entitled to collect on their debts. Bill H.R. 40 is a moral and political mistake. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hughes. Chill, 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 chill. He was presumptive, but he still has a right to speak.
He was listen to Steve Cohen, that lunatic congressman from Tennessee. How Tennessee, of all states, elected that screwball, Steve Cohen, to Congress. It's the nuttiest image of me. He's like, the crazy hair and the provocative, vile things he says. Chill, chill, chill. You heard the boos, right? Well, how about this reaction? and this is painful to say this, but I've got to, a liberal comedian and even a writer from HBO named Ray Sani, whoever that is, writes for a black lady sketch show on HBO. She wrote, "It's okay, just for today, to call Coleman Hughes," that's the young man you just heard from, "a coon. He's arguing against reparations on Juneteenth. He's Coon Man Hughes till midnight Pacific Standard Time." So a liberal writer from HBO named Ray Sani believes it is okay, just for one day, to call this serious, earnest, young black man, 23 years old, testifying before the House, it's okay to call him a coon. Because, after all, he's against reparations. I just love this lie that liberals aren't racist, that the far left doesn't have any racism. Did you see the story last week about the editor-in-chief of Campus Reform, Lawrence Jones? He's a young black man as well, 26 years old. He was interviewing people in New York City. There's no racism in New York City, right? Not with those enlightened liberal New Yorkers, right? Those libs in New York, they don't have a racist bone in their body, right? They're giving. They're inclusive. So 26-year-old Lawrence Jones went into an anti-Trump rally. It was some stupid rally in Manhattan promoting President Trump's impeachment. Two attendees confronted Lawrence Jones. One of them told him he should go back to Fox News, where there's more cotton for you to pick. When the man was asked to clarify what he meant or what he said, he just reiterated the racist remark. Then another anti-Trump protester said to Lawrence Jones, "He'll tell you to go back to Kenya next." So these enlightened New York libs, foul-mouthed racists who don't like black people, just like this enlightened, intellectual HBO writer who believes it's okay to call a young black man a coon because he's against reparations. That's the choice voters are going to have in November of 2020.
Coming up,
you don't grow single like you grow married.
Dennis Prager with a final segment of Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. If you enjoy Town Hall Review, and especially if you're a person of faith, let me invite you to listen to another podcast I know you'll enjoy, The Christian Outlook. This week, a special Independence Day edition, going back to the beginning.
The American Revolution was a faith-based revolution because Americans were a faith-based people, and that faith was a biblical one.
We'll look at efforts to remind the next generation of the uniqueness of the American experiment.
We have national Alzheimer's. Here we are, the freest country that planet Earth has ever seen, and we forgot how we got here.
And the challenges coming from our educational elites.
They go into the classrooms and they tell the students negative things about the founding fathers, and the students are repulsed by them.
To subscribe, go to ChristianOutlook.com. That's ChristianOutlook.com. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Mark Davis. A recent study by the National Center for Family and Marriage Research found the divorce rate is at a 40-year low. That's great at first blush, right? But a little digging reveals a troubling trend that contributes to that decline. A lot of people are simply not getting married. Some are cohabitating, playing house, playing the married role, having kids. Then they break up with many of the same complications, but one, no legal marriage to dissolve. Dennis Prager explains why marriage is good for individuals.
There are still rough edges that only marriage will be able to soften. That, you know, when you're on your own, it's very easy. Life, of course, can be easier if you're on your own. Of course it can. But is that the aim of life, to have it easy? Or is the aim of life, among other things, to grow? You don't grow single like you grow married. Okay? That's just an overwhelming fact. Is it true in every single instance on earth? Probably not. Nothing is true in every single instance on earth. But it's pretty true for just about everybody. Marriage makes you grow. I meet a lot of people who say that. I'm such a great life alone. I have all these friends. Listen, I want you to be happy if you're single. But if you can, in fact, remarry, you should. It's a good rule of life. Marriage makes you grow. It is astonishing to me how many young people need to hear this. Not just people who have been married 40 years and divorced or widowed. It is astonishing how many young people do not have, especially young women, do not have it even on their agenda. No. Career. Do you really think, is there anybody listening who really believes career will bring you greater happiness than marriage? I mean, obviously, we have to compare apples and apples. Successful career versus successful marriage. We are living in the age, as I often constantly say, the age of anti-wisdom. If it's conventional wisdom, it is to be rejected. It is to be overthrown. Career. Then what? By the way, careers end. You could say marriages end too. Theoretically, they end a lot later than careers do. Anyway, you want to go home to your career?
Hey, thanks for joining us for this edition of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Catch up on earlier episodes at our website, townhallreview.com, and sign up for a daily dose of the best in talk radio. And always follow us on Twitter at Town Hall Review. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Shubin, producers Charlie Richards, David Posian, Michael Cook, Jim Bartow, and Bob Belt. Let me say once again thanks to our sponsors, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. I'm Mark Davis, and this week for Hugh, and let me take just a moment to wish you and yours a very, very happy 4th of July. Happy birthday, America. May God have his mighty hand on our nation, and may freedom long endure. Thanks for joining us.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.